Good morning. I'm Maeve Conran. You are tuned in to Community Radio, listener supported KGNU. Coming up on today's Morning Magazine, we'll hear about the United States of distraction, media manipulation in post-truth America, and what we can do about it. That's the title of a new book by Nolan Higdon of Project Censored. He'll be speaking about the book at the Boulder Bookstore at a special event this Thursday evening. After that, we'll get a report from a town hall meeting just held by Andrew Romanoff. He's seeking to be the Democratic nominee in the Senate race to challenge Cory Gardner. It was held in an unusual location, a local bike store, and had a special guest, Jim Hightower. After that, we'll take a trip to the Western Slope and hear about a sport that's attracting more winter visitors to a town that was struggling economically. No comments left on the comment line this week, so we'll go back to BBC for headlines at the bottom of the hour. Then on How on Earth, we'll hear about Almost Human, the story of Julius the chimpanzee caught between two worlds. At 9 o'clock, it is the wit and wisdom of Alan Watts rounding out this morning's news and public affairs. But first, we'll begin with the latest local headlines. Here's Alejandra Wilcox.
Two new federal lawsuits have been filed against the GEO Group, a for-profit prison company that runs Aurora's Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, detention facility. The lawsuits allege that staff did not give adequate medical attention to one detainee and failed to investigate the assault of another. The Denver Post reports that the private prison company has come under fire in several states for allegations of medical neglect, maltreatment, forced labor, and disease outbreaks. Currently, Colorado lawmakers are working toward divorcing the state from the private prison industry. In February 2018, Renee Lima Marin, one of the plaintiffs in the lawsuits, was being held in the GEO Aurora ICE facility after being pardoned from a prison sentence by Governor John Hickenlooper. While waiting for his case to get through immigration court, Lima Marin says he slipped and fell in the ICE facility, striking his face on the steel edge of a toilet seat in his cell and breaking multiple bones. Doctors told him he would need surgery to avoid permanent damage. Lima Marin says that GEO staff never took him back to the hospital for surgery, despite his daily pleas. He also alleges that staff refused to fill his pain medicine prescription. Eventually, after winning his immigration case, Lima Marin went back to a doctor and was told the bones in his face had begun to heal incorrectly and would have to be rebroken in order to do the surgery. But now, because he was no longer in the company's custody, GEO refused to foot the bill. The other lawsuit, filed in January 2020, involves Lawrence Ritchie, who was violently beaten by a group of men in the Aurora GEO facility 2 years ago. In a lawsuit that also named the city of Aurora as a defendant, Ritchie alleges that GEO staff watched him get beaten and did nothing to stop it. According to an investigation from Rocky Mountain PBS News, Aurora police often leave investigations of sexual abuse or assault at the detention facility to GEO staff, who are not police officers. One civil rights attorney says that these lawsuits demonstrate GEO and ICE's, quote, lack of transparency and lack of accountability. Representative Jason Crow, a Democrat in Aurora, has called for weekly oversight visits of the facility. A bill that would replace Columbus Day with Cabrini Day won preliminary approval in the Colorado House of Representatives last week. Cabrini Day would honor Mother Frances Xavier Cabrini, an Italian-American Catholic saint who established orphanages for children in Colorado in the early 1900s. It would be the first state holiday named after a woman. Representative Adrian Benavides, a Democrat from Adams County, championed this bill. This is her third attempt to get it passed. Benavides says that Columbus Day has brought pain to indigenous people in Colorado and around the country. Fox 31 reports that Columbus Day has become controversial in recent years due to Christopher Columbus's treatment of indigenous people. Over 10 states have already repealed the holiday. The new bill would establish Cabrini Day as a paid state holiday on the first Monday in October, removing the state sanction of Columbus Day, which occurs 1 week later. Cabrini Day would honor Cabrini's humanitarian values and service to the children of Colorado. Opponents of the bill put up a strong fight, defending Columbus as an important figure to Italian Americans. Nobody in history except one person was perfect, said one Republican representative. A Democrat out of North Glen said holidays should be a time to reflect on and celebrate the lives of great historical figures whose lives and values Coloradans would like to emulate, before adding, quote, Columbus does not fit the bill and Francis Xavier Cabrini does. It's as simple as that. The bill will have a formal third reading vote before moving to the Senate. Also at the Colorado State Legislature, Democratic lawmakers say that despite a number of policies designed to protect undocumented immigrants, their measures will not create a sanctuary state. Under the Trump administration, sanctuary state has become a label used to target uncooperative communities. Senator Julie Gonzalez, a Democrat out of Denver, introduced a Senate bill that would prevent ICE agents from entering courthouses to effect civil arrests. According to the Denver Post, Gonzalez will also introduce a bill that would prevent disclosure of information to Immigration and Customs Enforcement from state databases, like the Department of Motor Vehicles. Gabriela Flora, the Denver Immigration Rights Program Director, says that Colorado has advanced considerably in the past 16 years. She cited the 2013 repeal of a law that once required police to report anyone they suspected might be undocumented to ICE. Now, undocumented immigrants are eligible to get driver's licenses. Flora told the Denver Post she sees these policies as a step forward, but that there are still gaps in protecting immigrant rights. While ICE officials had no specific comment, they did say the agency has concerns about any laws limiting information sharing. In weather today, partly cloudy, with highs of 36 degrees and snow showers expected tomorrow. It's currently around 19 degrees on the Front Range. For KGNU, I'm Alejandra Wilcox.
It is 10 minutes past 8 o'clock. What does it mean to live in post-truth America? And what is the state of media right now? Well, Nolan Higdon is tackling this particular issue in his latest book that he's co-authored with his colleague Mickey Hoff of Project Censored. It's called The United States of Distraction, Media Manipulation in Post-Truth America. And what we can do about it. He'll be speaking at the Boulder Bookstore this Thursday evening about it. I asked Nolan whether we're still in the same scenario when it comes to the media as we were back in 2016.
You know, our goal, we wrote this book, we hoped it would be obsolete by the time the 2020 election came around, you know, that sort of folks would have learned their lesson, and this book almost would have been a historical account. But unfortunately, we continue to point out that our thesis remains strong. There was some attempts at a, you know, like a come to Jesus apology moment by the press. You remember CNN had the commercial about how they promised they weren't going to, you know, fall prey to lies. They said if an apple is an apple, a banana is a banana, we're not going to say different. And the New York Times kind of wrote a letter that tacitly admitted to their readers that they had failed in 2016, and the Washington Post emphasized that democracy dies in the dark. But a lot of this stuff, and you know, Facebook as well with their sort of changes, all this stuff was really a public relations campaign to get people to have faith in these institutions again. There's no real evidence that they've changed anything. And as you point out, I think the treatment of Bernie Sanders and almost like the sensationalistic commentary on the abuses of the Trump administration and its treatment of the Constitution illustrate that we're still seeing a media system that treats this as some form of entertainment, and entertainment draws eyeballs, which equals revenue. And I don't really see them going down the route of doing meaningful journalism that reaches out to people. And it's quite scary going into 2016. I mean, as you know, Trump's approval ratings have hit the highest ever on record, and it's, you know, the same week that he gets acquitted for the impeachment charges in the Senate. And meanwhile, the Democrats are still kind of fighting this back and forth war between to find their party identity. And the press just kind of treats it all as entertainment. But hanging in the balance, you know, are crucial questions about democracy and the U.S. economy and the future of the country and at some level the future of the globe. You know, if we see what's going on in Australia and others, all those questions are kind of taking a backseat to this horse race entertainment politics.
Well, that idea of the horse race, I mean, we saw that play out so much recently in Iowa with the caucuses, where it seemed that all of this was being run for the benefit of CNN. We need to get corporate media the results as soon as possible so we can get reported as part of this kind of infotainment horse race style coverage of the elections. And I mean, there were many issues, as we saw play out in Iowa, but the energy behind all of that seemed to be, well, we got to get this out because this is what's expected of us by CNN.
Yeah, I thought that was really fascinating, that the emphasis by CNN and others was not on getting it right, it was getting it out. And, you know, it shows, I think, a disdain for democracy. You know, democracy is it's a very sort of fragile system, and you want to get it accurate, whether you enjoy the outcome or not, you want to get it right. But they weren't advocating for a fair and transparent democratic process. They were advocating for getting the numbers out so they could get the commentators on to discuss it. And I think you need no real further illustration of how these corporate bosses feel and treat democracy than what happened in Iowa.
Well, many people say that what we have right now in terms of Donald Trump is, I mean, it's like a reality TV show. I mean, he was a reality TV personality, and that energy has certainly been brought to the White House. And that is largely how we're seeing so much of the coverage being done. As you mentioned there, it's very often on the sensationalist aspects. There's so much that's happening right now that's not covered. And maybe we could talk a little bit about that, because it does seem that when there is a discussion about the state of the media, we get this mantra parroted out, oh, fake news, as if it's a monolith. And what's less discussed is really some of the stories that are largely being ignored, and not just under the Trump presidency, but we've seen under Obama and really previous presidents as well, that corporate media is just not reporting on some of the major issues. I mean, if you look at the climate crisis as an example, I mean, we have television channels dedicated to 24-hour coverage of the weather that have rarely even mentioned climate as part of that. So maybe talk a little bit about that, and then we'll dig into the fake news aspect. But the reality is that really for a long time, corporate media has failed to report on the substantive issues facing the country right now.
Yeah, there's these changes really go back to starting in the 1980s with the development of 24-hour news networks and the deregulation of media. And we talk about this in our book, that they used to have checks on the media to make sure they did their job. So you used to have a limitation on how many news outlets one company could own in a particular market. You used to have a fairness doctrine that said that if you sort of criticize one side ideologically, you had to pay to have that ideological side be able to rebut what you said. But we got rid of all of those safeguards in the 1990s. And starting around the 2000s, media really became all about profiteering. And the way they profited was not just in the content they focused on, but getting rid of a lot of positions. I mean, the first thing to go were overseas bureaus. So they fired these people who used to work overseas. So we know less and less about what's going on internationally as Americans. And then they similarly started getting rid of reporters that didn't work in huge markets. So if you weren't in a Chicago, Los Angeles, Atlanta, New York, D.C., you were sort of let go. So we don't know news about much of America outside of the cities. And they also, to make it even worse, they also cut weekends. Weekends weren't big for viewers and revenue, so there's not a lot of reporting that goes on weekends. So if you have any event that happens internationally in a non-big city or on a weekend, it doesn't get much coverage. And then they started using a lot of audience studies that were from television entertainment rather than news programming, and it showed that people... audiences tend to be turned off by inarticulate individuals or by big, complex, wonky stories. And so news media started to really simplify their stories. They got rid of having common people on television. And so they put people on who can sound like experts, but maybe are not experts. So long story short, the majority of the news we get is mostly commentators and critics talking about a very small slice of the world in a very simplistic way. And more complex stories like climate change, for example, which is, you know, to understand how something like the burning down of Australia has to do with climate change is pretty complex. You have to talk about the weather changing patterns and drying out and carbon emissions. That scene is way too wonky of a story. It's much better to do a story about how kangaroos are reacting to fires. That's a little more simplistic. They can sell that. They can show imagery of the fires and the burned kangaroos, and that'll be sensationalistic and get people in. But the actual, you know, story of climate change there and its impact on human existence moving forward and previously doesn't get covered. And as you pointed out, this has been decades in the making. Project Censored, who I'm associated with and have written for years, since 1976, have listed the top 25 stories that are covered by the independent press but ignored by the corporate press. And we get about 300 stories nominated every year that students and researchers document as being not covered by the corporate press but are covered by the independent press. And these are crucial stories about, you know, climate change dating back to the 70s that the corporate press would not cover, but the independent press would. And other examples could include, like, Watergate. You know, the independent press covered that for years before the corporate press would cover it. So there's a long history of the corporate press kind of ignoring these complex, wonky stories. And, you know, kind of lastly, to put a bow on this, in the 1990s, the networks figured out that really what drives people is conflict, right? This is the age-old way that entertainment is created, the story of good versus evil. So if you create some sort of conflict, people will tune in. And for news media, they realize some of the best conflict is partisan politics. So if you set up the good being your political party and the audience's political party and the evil being the other political party, you'll draw in eyeballs, you'll draw in readers, you'll draw in viewers. And so that's the way a lot of the programming has gone, is this real hyper-partisan path that talks about why your party is great and everything is wonderful and the other party is bad. You know, and that's problematic for two reasons. First, we live in a nation of 330 million people, so the idea that there's two parties is just absolutely insane. And secondly, sometimes the things the two parties agree on are almost more dangerous than what they disagree on. You think, like, the military-industrial complex, for example. At the State of the Union, Nancy Pelosi wouldn't give anything to Donald Trump in terms of support for his agenda. But when it came to Venezuela and this idea of overthrowing leaders, then she would stand up and clap for him, because despite how deep the hyper-partisanship appears on the surface, there are these areas of agreement, like the military-industrial complex.
Nolan Higdon will speak about his new book, United States of Distraction, Media Manipulation in Post-Truth America, and what we can do about it. He'll be at the Boulder Bookstore this Thursday evening at 7:30 p.m. I'm very fortunate to get to be in conversation with him at the Boulder Bookstore. You can find out more about that event at boulderbookstore.net. It is 8:21. You're listening to Community Radio, KGNU. Candidate for the Colorado Democratic Party nomination to the U.S. Senate, Andrew Romanoff, held a town hall meeting at an unusual location this week. That's Full Cycle Bike Shop on Pearl Street in Boulder. KGNU's Joe Ritchie caught some of his remarks.
With Colorado caucuses on March 7th and a primary election on June 30th, Andrew Romanoff is campaigning hard for new and young voters in an effort to earn the right to run for U.S. Senate against Republican Cory Gardner in November.
The point of getting power is not to keep it, it's to use it, to improve the lives of the people you represent. And I think what you've seen in Congress today, especially from folks like Cory Gardner, is a little confusion about why they're in office to begin with.
Romanoff, former Speaker of the Colorado House of Representatives, has not competed for a statewide office yet. And he needs to get past former Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper, who seems to be ignoring the competition for the Democratic nomination.
18 debates he's been missing. We did one just this weekend at Metro, last week at Regis. We've done events sponsored by the NAACP, by veterans in Colorado Springs. It seems to me if you wanted a senator who didn't show up and answer your questions, well, you've already got one. His name's Cory Gardner.
Romanoff was joined by political commentator Jim Hightower.
One of our Democratic contenders said that a majority of Democrats opposed Medicare for All. Hello. The latest poll in December showed 81% of Democrats in favor of Medicare for All. Two-thirds of independents. Apple pie doesn't get 81%.
both reject the idea of accepting large campaign contributions and believe that a progressive agenda will win more votes in November.
I don't know if you saw this video, but John Hickenlooper described the progressive priorities that we're running on, like the Green New Deal and Medicare for All, as, and these are Hick's words, the discredited ideas of Karl Marx and Joseph Stalin. I'm no relation to the czars of Russia, but it is still a painful reference to be compared to Stalinism. It's the kind of attacks we expected from Cory Gardner and the Republicans. I didn't realize we'd be up against Democrats who are parroting their talking points. How do we combat that?
Hightower was barnstorming Colorado over a President's Day weekend. He had stops in Colorado Springs, Denver, Longmont, and Boulder. At the Longmont Museum on Sunday, Jim Hightower spoke to a crowd of over 200. His talk was titled Food, Fracking, and Fellowship. Hightower once served as Agriculture Commissioner for the state of Texas. He gave a brief survey of Department of Agriculture attitudes toward farming in the U.S.
We have an agricultural policy that has gone from butts to nuts. Earl Butts, you might remember him, Uncle Earl, Secretary of Agriculture under Richard Nixon. And Earl stepped forward and said, this trend toward less farms is not bad. It's good that we have been able to produce an increasing amount of food with the work of a smaller percentage of our population. This releases people to do something useful in their lives. Ezra Taft Benson, Eisenhower's Secretary of Agriculture, said farmers need the spur of insecurity. Ronald Reagan said farm foreclosures and bankruptcies are part of the necessary solution. My program hasn't hurt anybody. No one's been thrown out in the snow to die. That's a high standard, isn't it? And Jimmy Carter, many of you will not make it, but it will be better for those of you who survive. And now, you know, here we are with Donnie Trump and gang, and we've got a guy who's Secretary of Agriculture now. His name is Sonny Perdue. He's out of Georgia. He enjoys mocking his constituency. What do you call two farmers in a basement? He asked in an ag industry gathering. A wine cellar, he guffawed. In America, he icily told hard-hit dairy farmers up in Wisconsin, the big get bigger and the small get out. Again, the Secretary of Agriculture.
Of course, Hightower weighed in on the Democratic presidential primaries in progress, taking questions from the audience.
When Pete Buttigieg returned to the United States from Oxford, he joined the McKinsey corporate group, 7,700 employees, one of the most powerful and conservative consulting groups in the world.
Yes.
Spent 3 years there. I'm concerned that that's where he's getting his money and he was groomed for what he's doing now. Do you have any thoughts about Pete Buttigieg?
Yes, I do. I think there are many good things can be said about him, and there are plenty of good people who support him. But you need to follow the money, the old story, because it's not just McKinsey, that's one thing, but he is the Wall Street candidate in the Democratic Party. And I can tell you from political experience in Texas, I know that if you take the corporate check, written on the back is the corporate agenda.
What can we do about Pentagon spending in the next decade?
Well, you have a chance right here because you're about to become the Space Force of America. it is a joke. It doesn't have... It's not a sixth branch of government at all, of armed forces at all. But all that aside, it is just the foot in the door that the military contractors want. And we've got to confront that because they're now asking for many billions of dollars more, and it will be an endless amount of money because space is infinite, right? And so that we can go fight, as Ted Cruz said, space pirates.
Jim Hightower's commentaries can be heard each weekday here on KGNU, and we can expect to hear his complete talk from Longmont on an upcoming edition of Alternative Radio. For KGNU, this is Joe Ritchie.
It's 8:28. No comments left on the comment line this week, so next we head to the San Juan Mountains. Lake City, which is located in the San Juan Mountains, is known as a summer vacation destination. However, the town wants to compete for tourist dollars year-round. One sport that's been attracting more winter visitors to the area is ice climbing. Laura Palmisano brings us this report from the annual Lake City Ice Climbing Festival.
Probably the biggest lesson I've learned from ice climbing. Usually steeper than they look.
Danny Cowley is talking about ice walls. The avid ice climber from Gunnison knows what he's talking about. He's been taking part in the Lake City Ice Climbing Festival since it started over a decade ago.
Love coming here. I love the access. Look at all the people that it can bring out.
Some ice climbing enthusiasts created the ice park about 15 years ago. They also started the festival to raise funds for the park's upkeep. Craig Blakemore, one of the park's founders, says it provides a place to climb that's safer than the backcountry, where avalanches and falling ice are a real danger.
It's different because you can just walk up and start climbing, and you don't have approaches, you don't need snowshoes or skis, and within 10 minutes of getting here, you're usually roped up and ready to go, so it's pretty user-friendly.
The park and festival were run by volunteers, but 3 years ago, Lake City took over the responsibility. Ben Hake is the town's park and recreation director.
We wanted to make sure it was able to be run like for years down the road, and we knew we could do it with the personnel we had, and it was a lot cheaper for us to do it.
Hake says since the town took over, the park and festival have increased in popularity.
This season was the busiest season ever that I've seen. We're just trying to fill every available hotel room in town and make the restaurants busier during the wintertime, just as an economic development opportunity.
Local sales tax figures show Lake City's plan is working. In 2019, winter tourism was up 12% over the previous year and 21% compared to 2017. Back at the Lake City Ice Park, Madison Hayden from Crested Butte says last season she came here weekly to climb.
We don't have an ice park in Crested Butte. We only have backcountry ice in Crested Butte. Wednesdays are so slow, we would be the only people in the ice park every week. It was incredible, and it was like a really awesome opportunity to learn how to get better.
I'm Laura Palmisano in Lake City.